Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 30. Shelley's on her way here, and she's with Orphan, said Lorraine. Good. I wish I had Agent Smith here. I have a feeling we're going to need his tactical skills. I'm short-handed, said Riker. The roster's full of other agents, said Lorraine. Not this kind. Besides, I need to be able to sleep where the wind blows. I'll explain that later. Can you call a meeting of the Joint Chiefs, he asked. Yes, sir, she said, opening her three-ring notebook with the lists of numbers by department. She resolved that she would put these numbers into her phone in her own way. It was against security protocol to have them in an unauthorized location, like a personal cell phone, but she felt she needed ready access. Besides, she was living in the White House. She sent the group text with her official signature and waited for the acknowledgments for a meeting in 2 hours. Hadid? Yes, Mr. President, he said, leaning away from the wall like he was suddenly reappearing in the Oval Office. He pointed up, reminding him that everything said in this room was recorded. Can we step out for a moment? He asked, pointing to the secure room off the Oval Office. Yes, sir, said Hadid, taking out his magnetic card and accessing the secret lock under the wainscot of the pastel cream-colored wall. There was the soft thud of the lock solenoid, and the door relaxed, making a small opening, which he pushed the rest of the way open. Come with me, he motioned to Lorraine, and the three of them entered the secret conference room. As the door closed securely behind them, they each took a seat in the red leather chairs in the softly lit room. Can you give me a report from Jones? Yes, sir. The most recent report is that Dick Daring and Kyle Kramer are in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He was originally sent there by JPL to share his knowledge of magnetism and gaseous solutions. They are now with two female investigative bloggers who have published the theft of at least one warhead from Nuclear Fuel Services in Irwin, Tennessee. They check out. They are under instructions to report and not to follow, said Hadid. You're asking for restraint from a street racer and a hacker that needed a presidential pardon before they were even arrested? Has that ever been done before? Asked Riker. No, sir. They are the first, said Hadid. Well, they did save the lives of Smith and Jones and the professor, he said. Yes, sir. May I ask how they expect to find a warhead? Asked Lorraine, a question that drew the attention of Riker as well. Jones reports they have a pair of sodium iodide detectors and a spectrometer in their car, said Hadid. Of course they do, said Riker, putting his hands up to his face to wipe the nervousness away. Okay, pretend we don't know anything about nuclear weapons, said Lorraine, trying to bring clarity. The detectors can pick up the warhead, if they're close enough. The alpha particles leave a residue if they are in place for very long. The neutrons are sort of sticky. They leave a trail. Only the nuclear trigger can be seen from a distance, but if they're smart, they would have removed them and secured them somewhere else, said Hadid. Holy shit, said Riker under his breath. And they just happen to have a detector lying around. What can be done to help my guys in the Purple Challenger, and where are they now? The last report is that they are trying to pick up the trail by going to Irwin, said Hadid. Jones already quashed an all-points bulletin on their car. For what? I mean, why was there an all-points bulletin? Were they racing? No, sir. The girls were arrested by the FBI for allegedly publishing confidential information on their website. The boys chased down the arresting agents, disabled their vehicle, and rescued them, he said. What was the nature of the confidential information? They stated that warheads had gone missing from Nuclear Fuel Services inventory, said Hadid. And how did they know that? Asked Riker. They published the manifest on their website and circled the missing warheads. The FBI was monitoring their website, said Hadid. Okay. First, how did they get a copy of the manifest? And second, how many warheads were circled? Asked Riker. They must have a whistleblower inside the NRC. And I believe there were 6 warheads circled, said Hadid. Holy Mother of God, said Lorraine. 6? What the hell? Asked Riker. It usually is an accounting error. They have more than a ton of nuclear material missing. But that is over a period of 2 years, said Hadid. Who says it's an accounting error? Asked Riker. The NRC monitors, said Hadid flatly. So, we don't know. We have no idea when one of these things could be used in a U.S. city, said Lorraine, raising her voice. Where's Smith when I need him? He said under his breath. Smith is active, sir, said Hadid. What? Smith is active. He and Bet are using her phone to coordinate things through Jones. He only has one arm, said Hadid finally. I don't need his arms. I need his tactical brain. Where is his phone? He asked with firmness. He destroyed the phone as the GPS locator in it had been compromised, endangering Shelley LaSalle, said Hadid. Bring them in. We're too close on this event, and I need them here. Bet too, said Riker. Yes, sir. Now, give me an update on the professor, said Riker. Jones dispatched a jet for them at Hawthorne Airport. They depart at 10 p.m. Pacific, said Hadid. So that's it, then. The team will be here. Lorraine, will you see they all have quarters here? We cannot risk any of them. We're running out of time. And keep track of Dick and Kyle. They are out on the front lines, he said, standing up and heading for the Oval Office. Yes, sir, she said. Hadid led the way as the three walked up to the secret doorway into the Oval Office and closed the door behind them. I have responses from every member of the Joint Chiefs. They can meet today, given a 2-hour notice, said Lorraine. Set it up, said Riker. I'm texting Jones now to get Smith and Bette Dyson on the flight from Hawthorne, said Hadid. Riker sat down in his chair and took a deep breath. Lorraine, you go and get the conference room ready and make sure we have a copy of that manifest. Yes, sir, said Lorraine as she walked out of the door of the Oval Office. Where's Jones? Asked Riker. West Wing, said Hadid. Make sure he attends the meeting with the Joint Chiefs, said Riker. Yes, Mr. President, said Hadid, continuing to text on his phone. Riker turned his chair around to look out the window and gather his thoughts. He knew there was a national outrage against the crime syndicate in Washington, D.C., whose roots had spread throughout the agencies. Trillions of dollars was flowing through these roots to feed a network of corruption that was being led by an ancient and ruthless power that no longer needed fear of eternal damnation as its driving force. That force had been augmented by greed and a lust for global control in an engineered plan now more than 80 years in the making. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were funding a bloodletting of American wealth built with 3 centuries of free market capitalism in a highly coordinated plan to capture the entire world with financial treachery. Practically every nation on Earth had their banks compromised by economic hitmen. Leaders who resisted them or tried to expose their agents of evil were assassinated. Ambassadors, governors, presidents, and even candidates for those offices had been murdered in a coordinated fashion to protect and advance their agenda of stealing the world's wealth, marketing a merciless army of jihadists, and disarming the United States. Now, at the end of the age, the two Earths were dividing like a living planet-sized cell orbiting the sun. The affinity of sentient beings on the child planets of this birth would determine on which cell they would reside for the rest of eternity. The spiritual harvest described in the scriptures was real. The terms of that harvest were known to every people on Earth for thousands of years, and yet the people seemed to march forward inexorably to a predicted grand division. The people on Earth were trapped in a race for material wealth, and the ones who felt like they could win that race were the very ones who led that march. The ones who could not struggled like baitfish caught in an ever-shrinking net, and it would not be long before they suffocated to death. The global elitists were somehow happy that the population of poor and disenfranchised masses was going to perish. They had built economic and physical shelters for themselves that they believed would save them from the coming cataclysm, just like the Nephilim's offspring in the days of Noah before the flood. They seemed to mock the coming cataclysm, just like the ones who thought they could survive on higher ground without Noah's assistance. These thoughts began to weigh upon him. His chest felt heavy, and he thought about his wife being spared this birthing process. He wondered if she was watching him, praying for him at this very moment. Was he an unwitting participant in a prophetic path that was set in stone before the world was formed? He could see the people forming pockets of light scattered across the planet, holding hands and plodding through the mush of broken bodies and dreams to a place where they might be delivered from the carpet bombing of the world banks. He closed his eyes and saw the planetary picture of mankind and the rich array of life in all its forms. He zoomed in with his mind and saw every soul, every living thing, and even the spectrum of matter that made up this world was like layers of dots, like a lithograph. One by one, the stochastic frequencies of life and all matter were lifted from the planet, until the entire world was left as a cold, black and gray shadow of its current composite. Billions of people in countless forms of colorful life were separated from billions of other life forms that made up the gray background. He opened his eyes and felt hours had passed. The desperation of an ancient intelligence so evil and so full of rage that even in the midst of this inevitability, it would use nuclear weapons to somehow tilt the balance in its favor. It wanted souls, not just death. It wanted to fill the holds of its ship headed for darkness like a massive fishing vessel casting its final global nets. He sensed the spiritual helplessness of mankind as each soul struggled for air. He closed his eyes again. He wanted to be far away from this chair. It was several moments before he felt the hand on his shoulder. "Robert," the soft voice came from behind him. "Huh?" he said, opening his eyes as though returning from a distance. The hand gently slid off his shoulder, and he slowly swiveled back to face his desk. There, sitting on the love seat across the room, was Lorraine, with her legs crossed and leaning against the back. Her face was calm and peaceful, and her eyes were unblinking. "Mr. President," she said with a different sound than the one he had heard in his daydream. "Yes," he said, clearing his throat and scooting his chair up to place his hands on the desk. It felt foreign and large to him, like a boy playing for a moment. "The Joint Chiefs are ready, sir," she said calmly. "I didn't want to disturb you." He struggled for a moment. The voice had called his name, not his title. It washed over him like clean water cleaning the wound on his soul. It was familiar, and yet he could not place it. "Yes. Well, we better get to it," he said, pushing the chair back and standing on wobbly legs. "Are you all right?" she asked, standing as well. "Yeah, I must have dozed off. Let's go," he said, walking up to her. "Where's Hadid?" "He's right outside. He opened the door for me and was busy talking on the phone, not wanting to disturb you," she said. "How long was I..." he began and lost his thought. "Oh, just for a minute or so. I just got here," she said, trying to cover for her perception of invasion of his privacy. Within a few minutes, they had walked to the West Wing and into the small conference room where the Joint Chiefs of the Armed Forces awaited. The only one missing was the late Army General Cabarrus. Riker had not allowed him to be replaced yet, leaving the Undersecretary of the Army to sit in his stead. He was a 3-star general who had served almost his entire military career in the Middle East at the center of conflict. He was battle-hardened and far from the politics of Washington. "As you were, gentlemen," said Riker. "I have asked my chief of staff and agents Hadid and Jones to attend as well. We have a situation of grave importance that has come up." More grave than the one we already face? Asked Admiral Samuel Dinetti of the Navy. It seems someone is planning to take advantage of the planetary chaos we are facing. Agent Jones, will you provide a current report of the situation? Asked Riker. We have reason to believe that 6 warheads have been stolen from the inventory at Nuclear Fuel Services in Irwin, Tennessee, began Jones. Good Lord, said Dinetti. Are you sure it is not another paperwork error? Asked the Undersecretary, drawing a glare from General Smart of the Air Force and General Bainberry of the Marines at the lack of protocol of having a lower-ranking general in the meeting. Let's set the politics aside, generals, said Riker. We looked into that. I have here the manifest of inventory, he said as Lorraine handed him the stack of confidential documents. He tossed them on the table, and they began handing them around. These are W-84 warheads, said Dinetti. Yes, they are, said Riker. What else do we know? What's the source of these documents? Asked Bainberry with his gruff voice. Riker looked at Jones to continue. A pair of bloggers were given these documents from someone inside the company. They're genuine, said Jones. Hadid leaned tall and ready on his hands against the wall, carefully watching the expression and presence of each person in the room. His weapon was inches away from his hand, and every man in the room knew it. Jones continued, There is a small civilian team very close and very capable of discovering where they are headed. Gentlemen, what I am about to tell you may be hard to hear. There is a plot to use at least one of these weapons to complete an attack on Mecca, said Riker with authority. There was silence in the room as the tactics and impact of such an attack were considered. There were always plans upon plans in the military-industrial world. Riker used to call the Pentagon Wars R Us. The entire building was built around contingencies for every possibility, except this. Mr. President, if I may, asked the Undersecretary. Speak freely, General, said Riker, sitting back in his chair for a moment. This will be the first time Saudi Arabia has been attacked directly. The Shia Muslims ordinarily would not be too heartbroken about such a thing, but this will be seen as an attack on Islam itself. The impact would plunge the entire world into war overnight, he said. That was our thought at first. Lorraine, will you share your thoughts with us? Asked Riker. There never had been a female chief of staff. There had never been a female, except a top-level cabinet member, even addressed the Joint Chiefs. The men in this room were the most powerful military commanders in the world. There was a chill in the room as the dress uniforms stiffened the necks of the men in them. Generals, a nuclear attack on Mecca will be devastating in a spiritual sense as well. Muslims must complete a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in their lives in order to reach heaven. The entire area for miles in every direction will be uninhabitable for decades, stranding hundreds of millions of the faithful, began Lorraine. Well, that would be a shame, said General Bainberry, shifting in his seat with glee. Also, generals, the fact that Allah appeared to be unable to protect their holiest city from desolation would shatter the credibility of their deity. They would have no point to focus for their prayers, and they would feel that their God, even if he did exist, had abandoned them in the hours before the global conquest they had been seeking since Muhammad began spreading the religion by the sword in the 7th century, said Lorraine with a tone that reached the very core of each man at the table. Sounds like it would complete what we've been trying to accomplish since Thomas Jefferson sent the Marines to kill those sons of bitches on the shores of Tripoli, said Bainberry with a tone of pride in his gravelly voice. Generals, she continued, there is a global war for the souls of mankind in process as we speak. The dark spirits of murder and mayhem are already his. The gate will soon close on the Grand Division, and I think he means to capture those who condone or participate in revenge as well, she said. "He who?" asked Bainbury, looking around the room for support. "There is a Nephilim alive and well and sitting at the head of the global elitists that have been bleeding the life out of us for more than 150 years, said Lorraine. "We have evidence that your own organizations have been compromised as well." Her words sat like a live grenade on the table in front of them. Riker knew he had picked her for a reason. She knew the truth, and she was unafraid to speak it. Her clear eyes and square chin told each man at that table that he backed her every point. "A Nephilim? Ms. McKenna, you want us to believe in a biblical being that is still alive and somehow in charge of all the bad things happening in the world?" asked Bainbury. "She's right," said Donetti finally. "We have interrogated several individuals inside our own forces. I have subs out there no one in the world knows about, but somehow my most trusted officers tell me this dark force is among them. They each testify under oath about the presence of a Nephilim at the global helm," he said. "Where is it located, this Nephilim?" asked the undersecretary. "That's the bad news, gentlemen," began Riker. "We don't know where he is, but we do know he is only a soldier. There is a commander above him that taps into a war that has been going on across the universe for millennia. What we're concerned with is this war on this planet, specifically with this Nephilim. Make no mistake, generals, he has been working this plan for more than 150 years to destroy America, and he is very close to accomplishing it. All the wealth in the world is now owned by less than 100 people. They use warfare, economic chaos, and religious confusion to control the world, and it's working. We don't have enough time or resources to fight him, but we know what he wants. He wants to capture the souls of all mankind," said Riker. "What the hell?" said Bainbury. "Why don't we find the bastard and nuke his ass into Kingdom Come? All we have to do is get close." "Are you insane? Millions would die," said Donetti. "God would sort them out," said Bainbury, folding his hands on the table in front of him. "Although you may be right, General, the Nephilim is victorious when souls choose darkness over light. Are you willing to send all your officers and soldiers to hell in order to kill one off-world being?" asked Lorraine. "Lady, take a look around. We've already been there," said Bainbury, dropping his voice to a frightening quiet. "I'm sorry, Generals, but we have a primary concern here. I want those nukes found. I need solutions, and I need them yesterday. Once these nukes make it out of the country, our job becomes exponentially more difficult." "Dismissed," said Riker as he stood to leave with his team. "Mr. President," began Donetti, "it is most likely they will try to get these out by sea. If they have removed the triggers, as we suspect, they can be recovered. But if they did not, we could have a bigger problem if we attempt to board and recover the warheads. My sailors, Mr. President." Riker glanced at Jones and then at Lorraine. He could feel their hearts beating in his head. "Make sure, Admiral. Then sink them," he said. Hadid opened the door and waited with his eyes on each of the men in the room as the President, Jones, and Lorraine left the room. He nodded to Donetti without a word and walked out the door.